studies of the equation of state in the, of the interior, and there's a whole range of physics options you have to think about now. And of course, these days, people are interested in gravitational waves coming up, and to what extent is the neutron star interior? How well do we have to understand that to be able to, you know, is there some important input into gravitational wave astronomy or the other way? You know, can it go the other way? Okay, so I thought I'd start up, I'm just gonna make a point, and so I'm just gonna show this cartoon here, which was drawn by Danny Page. And what he tried to do here was just to draw a cartoon and put in all the different pieces of theory that we think are going on inside a neutron star. And so I've taken a solar mass and I've collapsed it down to 10 kilometer size. The central densities are well above nuclear, maybe several times nuclear density. But the but as I go out, the density is dropping. Oh, thanks. Yeah, great. Hockey, excellent. Maybe I have some hockey stick plots in my talk. I don't know if I do. No, I'll do it this way. Okay. I don't play hockey, as you can tell. So there's a lot of interesting stuff here. And the reason I just show this to begin with is just to make a point, because I think it's interesting if, you, if you're not really if you're outside the field, if you're not studying neutron stars, and you see a plot like this, what do you take away from it? It's what?
Like interior of Earth.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. It looks a lot like Earth in the sense that it has a solid crust and has a very thin atmospheric layer. That's right. And it's, there are actually lots of analogies, you know, dynamically in terms of Rossby number and sort of fluid dynamics aspects. There are analogies one can draw. But that's not why I show this complicated diagram here. You know, I just look at this and I think there are two reactions. One is we must have a lot of detailed observations of neutron stars. Right? Or the other reaction is that the theorists have been allowed to run wild. You know, I usually make this joke, right? So for 30 years, the theorists have... So what's been interesting to me, I think, in the last 5 years or a few years is that we're beginning to get all kinds of observational handles on many of these different questions. So that's what I want to try to get across. That we really have to think a bit harder and some of these things are being constrained. Okay, so I'll give a bit of an introduction just to give a bit of background, you know, how have people been going about this? And I thought I'd talk a little bit about radius measurements because there's been some progress there. And I'll talk about something called thermal tomography, which I've been working on quite a bit. Okay, so traditionally, how have people tried to go after the neutron star interior? So the idea is that in the core of the neutron star, we have material which is above nuclear density. We don't know how to calculate from first principles what the equation of state of that material is. We'd like to constrain it somehow. And so historically, the way people try to do this was by looking at gross, what I would call gross properties of the star. And one of those is the size, the radius of the star. Right? And so there's this idea that there's a mapping between the equation of state, the pressure-density relation, which is shown in this figure here. There's a direct mapping between that pressure-density relation and then the final mass-radius relation for the star. And so in these plots here are shown mass-radius relations. So here's the radius of the star as a function of mass for different theoretical inputs. And that directly corresponds to different choices for the equation of state here in the interior. So that's sort of a bulk measurement. You're just looking at, for if I take a solar mass neutron star, is it 12 kilometers or 15 kilometers or 10 kilometers? It measures the compressibility of the nuclear material. Yeah. Yes, so time matters only in the very, very beginning, but very quickly it's degenerate material, so it's essentially a zero temperature object, and I'm going to be studying older neutron stars. So
history, how it formed, it has no bearing on this parameter, like mass and the radius.
It could. I can make different masses. Yeah, that's right. So in different supernovae, I can make different masses, for example. But the point is that. But if you tell me the mass, there should be a unique radius. Yeah, that's right.
Well, I guess there is also angular momentum.
If I'm spinning very rapidly, I could have some rotational distortion. That's right. Yeah. And fields. Well, I think that's more difficult. But you know, if you have very strong fields, the equipotential fields 10 to the 18 Gauss, and the highest fields we so directly measure are more like 10 to the 15. So there's a bit of a gap there. Those are surface fields, that's right, yeah. But it's hard to build structures where you have an increase of the field by, say, a factor of 1,000. And then there's also stability issues too. If I try to make something which is essentially magnetically supported, you know, becoming magnetically supported, it becomes unstable.
Is there an observational way of saying how old is time?
Yes, we have some ideas of ages, and I'll show you a plot in a minute of some observations of ages. But it's one of those difficult things in astronomy, determining ages. You know, so you get into these classical astronomical problems. But you can do something. So for example, people try to measure. If I have a magnetized neutron star which is spinning a pulsar, it's spinning down, and you use that spin down rate to estimate the age, for example, right? Or if it's in a supernova remnant, if it's a historical supernova remnant, we might know exactly what the age is, you know, that kind of thing.
But presumably, most of the stars, from that perspective, are old, right?
Yeah, most neutron stars we don't know. You know, so in the galaxy, there are 100 million, and we know a few thousand. So most of them are old and dim and faint, and we don't see them. But for this problem, essentially it's a zero temperature object, and the radius is dominated by the bulk equation of state of the material throughout the core, and so there is just this mapping. So the idea is if I could measure a few objects on this plane, and ideally I'd measure say 10 objects, and I'd map this out, and then those 10 data points I can map across, and I essentially have 10 measurements of the equation of state at different densities. So that's the kind of thing that people try to do. Okay, and just out of interest, you'll notice that the radius is essentially constant in many of these, that the tracks are mostly vertical in this plot, or very close to vertical. And that's because the equation of state is very close to pressure goals like rho squared. And if I make a gravitationally supported object with this equation of state, I tend to get a constant radius coming out, okay? The Fermi energies are 100 MeV, something like that, in this very center. So you have degenerate, say if I just have neutron, proton, electron fluid, the Fermi energies are balanced, it's about 100 MeV, something like that, just set by the gravitational binding energy. Okay, so, and just one thing to mention that's been interesting in this field, in this particular aspect of constraining masses and radii. We now have two examples. Here's one from 2010 of a two solar mass neutron star. So one way you can go about this is you can measure the radius, or you can also just try to put limits on the mass. Because if you look at difference equations of state, they have two different characteristics. One was this sort of vertical track in terms of radius that I was mentioning. But the other one is that they all turn over and they all have a maximum mass. So if you can limit that maximum, if you can measure a two solar mass neutron star, it tells you, for example, that this equation of state here doesn't get to two, so that it can't be right. I can't make a two solar mass neutron star this way. So that's been an important development just in the last few years. There are now two examples of these. They're both very close to two. And so people just, that's one thing people do, is try to find neutron stars, measure their masses, and try and find the most massive one we can. And even that one data point is interesting. Yeah. So I'm going to talk about this a little bit in a minute. So in the general picture, if it's very soft, then you imagine it, you can't make it a massive object, but you can tweak how stiff and soft it is as a function of density, and so you can play around with the radius and the mass, and you can play with those two numbers by making a stiff or soft at a high or low density, and so there are ways you can get around certain constraints. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. Oh yeah, so this is how these masses are measured. So it's a binary system which is almost edge-on, and the neutron star is going behind a companion, and you measure the time delay, you measure the Shapiro delay, and that's how you get the mass of the object that's causing the delay. And this is just showing timing information. The distance of the system, I don't know, but it's substantial. I mean, it's not nearby. It's within our galaxy. It's within our galaxy, but it's not sort of local. I don't know the distance for this one. And the separation here, I can't remember the orbital period for this one, but typically these are pretty close binaries, you know, within a source, an AU.
Radius,
so it's that the pulsar sending off, the pulsar sending off periodic pulses. But those pulses, when the pulses pass by the companion, there's a gravitational redshift effect, so they don't arrive when you think they should arrive. And that's what they're showing here. There's this increase in the delay. There's a delay. And that's the Shapiro delay, yeah. So you're measuring the gravitational redshift within the binary system itself as the pulses are trying to leave to come to the observer. They have to, they become their gravitational redshift. Yeah, this is a double neutron star system, this one. So you see that lets you direct, that's a really good mass measurement then. You get a really good constraint number there.
So you,
which, you mean, do these curves? No, I don't think so. I think it's very hard. It's very hard. If you try to make a model of a star, just a gravitational equilibrium with rapid spin, what you tend to find is that the structure of the object tends to be that the outer layers will have most of the angular momentum and be sort of almost coming out as like a disk, you know. So you form a rotationally supported disk essentially, and then the inner part doesn't have a lot of rotational support. That tends to be how those structure goes. So I think it's very hard to do this with rotation. And then of course you have to keep it rotating at that rate for a long time. So it's difficult to do. Okay, so that's one thing people are doing. And I was gonna talk a little bit about radius measurements. How do people try to measure the radius coming this way? Okay, but before I do that, I'll just say that the other way that people historically have tried to constrain neutron star interiors, this is kind of like a mechanical property, but also to look at the thermal property. So you get these plots like this, where people plot now the temperature of the neutron star surface. It's in log, so it's a million degrees here, as a function of time, again in log. So it's 10 years going out to a million years. And the idea is that over a million years, the neutron star will cool. And if you measure a bunch of neutron star temperatures and you try to measure the age and you put them on a plot, you can try to figure out which of these models goes through the data. And that's telling you that the zeroth order thing that you get out is how efficient the neutrino emission is. I lost my hockey stick. So so the curves up here have slow neutrino emission, and the curves that come all the way down here get very cold. They have very fast, efficient neutrino emission. So the idea is just by looking at where you are during this period, you can tell how hot the neutron star core is. That tells you how efficiently it's emitting neutrinos. So people try to do that, but again, it's difficult. It's difficult to get ages in astronomy. So how well do we really understand the ages of these things? And also, there aren't many objects. You know, it's hard to do this. And again, it's like a global integrated property of the star. I'm looking at what's the total neutrino emission of the whole star. And so something I want to try to show you is that now we can have a much more detailed sort of look at this.
How is the temperature measurement?
It's fitting a spectrum. Okay. So there are uncertainties in these points also due to, for example, what do I think of the atmosphere is made of? So I can move them up and down by probably about that much if I change the atmosphere from iron to helium, for example. Yeah, sorry, X-rays. Yeah, you look in X-rays, you detect in soft X-rays, and you try to fit a thermal spectrum, and you extract the temperature. And you can also do it in terms of luminosity as well. You could try and do it in terms of luminosity as well.
What are the lines again? The curves?
The curves are theoretical models for how the surface temperature should evolve over time. So I just take a hot neutron star from a supernova and let it cool in my simulation. I just simulate what the surface temperature should be doing. It's related to the equation of state because the neutrino, and that's why I put this panel here, if I have fast or slow emission, it tells me something about the interior composition. So some compositions are, if I just have regular neutrons and protons, then I can get this direct Oerker reaction here. I have a beta equilibrium inside the star between neutrons and protons and electrons. But if I have a little bit of KT, a little bit of thermal energy, then I can have these reactions happening, and the thermal energy can be taken away as the neutrino and antineutrino. So that's a sink of energy, right? That's the direct Oerker process. But if I introduce, but for that to happen, I need enough protons. It's just a momentum conservation thing in the reaction. So if I don't have enough, if I don't have a high enough proton fraction, I'm going to have slow cooling, not fast cooling. And that's the basic difference. So. It's still producing neutrinos. It's not that you shut off neutrino production, but it's. Oh, sorry, pair produce. They're not hot enough. It's not significant here. So it's true in the crust, for example. If I make a very hot crust, I can have pair, nu nu bar, know, Bram Stralong say and Nunabar comes out, but here this is not, but yeah. So especially when you get over here, the core temperatures are quite low. I mean, they're 10 to the 8 Kelvin, but it's low. Okay, so again, it's kind of a crude thing. In some ways, I look at this and I try to see, where am I in the spectrum of neutrino emission? But it's not a very detailed look in the sense of, can I really see what particles are there? I just know, are there enough particles I can have a direct process rather than a slow process, for example? Okay, and this is the point of the talk, in 140 characters or less, you know. I think the point is that there's a lot of transient behavior that we see in neutron stars, and that's telling us a lot more detailed information than these sort of traditional methods, which are more like global averages, you know. So that's really the point of what I wanted to say. And I'll just mention that in terms of neutron star cooling, there was an interesting result, which along these lines, which you might have heard of, which is this cooling that was observed in Cassay. The Cassay supernova remnant has a neutron star at its center. And this is the observation here. This is the surface temperature against time, but now it's not over a million years, it's over 20 years now. So the Chandra X-ray telescope saw the surface temperature change by a significant amount over about 10 years, 15 years. And that slope is very steep. You know, those cooling curves, they're cooling over a million years, so you shouldn't see anything happening in 10 years. And so this was a puzzle, but people realized that there is a way to explain it, which is that if I look at these neutron star cooling curves, this is what I showed you before, it's cooling over a million years. But what's happening here is that the crust of the star is thermally relaxing, and then I can get a very rapid drop here, and it's associated with a superfluid transition in the core. So when the... So we think that the core can be a superfluid, and if I have a temperature which is similar, comparable to the gap energy, then when I'm at that temperature, I have fluctuations which break and make Cooper pairs, or I can think of it that way, and every time I do that, I can send out neutrinos, and so it can act as an energy sink. But it only happens when I'm just at the right temperature near the gap temperature. And so the idea here is that in these models, what people do is they choose the gap temperature. And then as you're cooling through the gap temperature, you get efficient neutrino emission, and the core suddenly drops in temperature, and you can get a very rapid decrease in the surface temperature. It's about the only way that we think we can do it at 300 years. Yeah, it's the only explanation that seems to work. And to be fair about this, I think there are some issues. So for example, you have to tune it a little bit. It's a little bit tuned, because this is the one object that we know that's 300 years old. And we've only looked for 10 years at this object, and we happen to be looking just when it's undergoing this rapid cooling phase. So there's a bit of a fine-tuning argument. It's about something like 50 or 60 years out of 300. So it's about a 20% chance. So maybe that's okay, but... But we don't have any that we could have seen. We don't have any 300 years old like this. They're all older. So it's sort of funny. The one that we could have seen this, we do see it. You know, it's a little bit. And then that's right. I mean, these extra telescopes, Chandra's been flying for how many years now? I don't know, 15 years now. And over the lifetime of the mission, things degrade and things change. And you have to worry, is there a systematic effect here in these temperature measurements? Could it just be, you know, satellites aging in some way, and that it could be. But if you take this, you know, people check. They try to do all kinds of checks with the data that they can. But you should bear in mind that these things can happen, and it's very difficult measurement. It's very, there aren't many photons here that you get to do these measurements with. That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. You can cross-calibrate with other sources and try to check that your calibration is stable, or that you understand the changes over time. That's right.
And the initial temperature is when?
Yeah. Well, so here's all that data collapsed onto this million-year time scale. And
you have a temperature here, T equals zero.
Yeah, here.
I'm just trying to see if you fell from here or you fell from over there.
Yeah, it doesn't quite... So what's happening, it doesn't, I don't think it matters too much. I think you, well, actually, it could matter in the sense that if I change the initial temperature, maybe I have to change my gap temperature a little bit.
Right.
Yeah, there's probably some degeneracy there, that's right. So if you ask how well have we really measured the gap temperature here, there could be a kind of uncertainty like that coming in. That could be right. Yeah, the gap temperature they need here is a few by 10 to the 8 Kelvin, something like that. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. Anyway, so that's been the interesting thing in terms of thermal evolution. This happened. It's just fit to the data. So it's yeah, it's about in the middle of the range that people had imagined. So you could go from say 10 to the 8 to probably a few by 10 to the 9. You know, 10 to the 9 Kelvin is an MeV, so it's this nuclear energy scale of the interaction. So something around there. These are other objects that have been seen. These aren't observed to change over time. So the slope here is so steep that you can see in 20 years, but these ones you'd never be able to see in 20 years.
Yeah, but what I mean is that you haven't already found out what's going on. You kind of see here a relation. I mean, these points are close to the
Yeah, no, that's right, yeah. I mean, in general, these cooling models do pretty well. I mean, they seem to go through the data that we have if you choose the neutrino emission appropriately. Right, so. Okay, keep going. All right, so, but we have a lot of transient data. And so I'm just going to flash up this plot. I tried to plot a whole range of different things. So this is all transient, different transient observations from neutron stars, mostly accreting neutron stars, but also magnetars. And what I've tried to do is just plot a whole range of different, each color and different symbol is a different kind of behavior. And over the last decade, or a bit more, people have been looking with X-ray telescopes and just monitoring neutron stars. And we see a whole range of stuff going all the way from second timescales all the way to, say, 10 years. So there's actually a whole range here. And I don't have time to obviously just talk about all these different pieces, but what we've been doing is looking at these different events and trying to figure out what are they telling us about neutron star interior physics, and there's a whole range of different physics that one can go after, whether it's carbon, propagation of carbon burning flames, or magnetic field decay, or the conductivity of the crust. By looking at different timescales, the idea is we get a handle on different locations within the star, and that's the general message. It's the time variation of the luminosity of the star. And I've only plotted things here that we can interpret as cooling. So it's the star cooling down.
So all the candidate is going down.
Yeah.
But why there's no neutron star that increases?
Because what's happening here is that I'm going to talk a little bit more about what's really going on here. But in these different events, what happens is I have a rapid heating, which is not shown here. So the star suddenly gets hot, and then it thermally cools and relaxes slowly. And so what I'm showing here are different kinds of events where I've heated the star by some thermonuclear instability or by accretion. I can talk about that, different ways of heating the star quickly, and then you just let it thermally relax. Okay. So this is really just to, I'm just showing you this as a, I don't know why I'm showing you this now, really, but it's probably confusing. But I'll try to talk as much as I can. I mean, this is really just to say we've been doing a huge amount of things at different timescales, and I'm going to talk about a little bit of this. Obviously, I won't get time to talk about it. I'll try to give you the general principle of how one can understand this kind of behavior. But the point is just that Cassay is not the only object that we've seen changing in time. There are many neutron stars that we've seen showing variability on many different timescales that we can associate with cooling. And the cooling we see tells us a lot in principle about the internal structure. Okay.
I noticed that you don't put on there like glitches. I mean, not glitches. I mean, these things where the spin down rate changes. There's one model of it where it's like deepening of a.
Right. That's right. No, it's not that I'm not commenting at all on that model, on glitches. No, but it is relevant. It's glitches, when you see those plots you're imagining of spin down changes, what you're plotting there is the spin against time, and you see the spin change. That in regular radio pulsars, that has not been connected with a change in the X-ray luminosity, say. But what is interesting is in magnetars, which are these 10 to the 15 Gauss magnetically active objects, there I do see glitches that are associated with X-ray variability. And so some of these Lykovs here, I can't, like this, which one? This red one, actually. This is a magnetar that underwent a cooling of its X-ray luminosity over a few years, over a year or so. And there was a glitch there also. So it's very interesting to study these. And so I could have put on here, you know, part of this physics that we can look at here in principle is glitches. So, yeah. Yeah, but it's just here, I'm just plotting cooling curves. I'm just sort of focusing in, let's focus on the cooling. But there's a very interesting question to ask about the connection. If I see a heating event, do I see a glitch? And if I see a glitch, do I see a heating event? And, yeah. Okay. So I thought, because there has actually been a lot of work done on radius measurements recently, and I thought I'd spend a little bit of time talking about it. Okay. So I just want to give you a sense of that, and I'm just going to highlight what I think of, I'm trying to give you a sense of the current state of that right now, and there's a little bit that we've contributed to this. Okay, so the first point is that the theory, from a theory point of view, if you ask how well can we predict a neutron star radius, there's a very interesting point that's been raised in a couple of papers now recently, which is that if I look at these radius curves, so here's again mass and radius, if I take one of these models, let's take the black curve, for example, as I come in from very low mass and I increase the mass, I'm coming into smaller radii, increasing the mass, that means that the central density is going up. And here actually are lines of constant central density in terms of nuclear density. So here, twice nuclear density, three nuclear density, and so on. So what that means is that if I make a very low mass neutron star, which is very puffy, so if I make an object over here, the central density could be around nuclear density. And we think one can understand the equation of state reasonably well up to, say, nuclear density. The problem really is when I go well beyond nuclear density, how do I extrapolate the equation of state in the material? But the point these papers make is that because this part of the mass-radius relation depends on the low-density equation of state, then, and if you notice, what they all come in and then they turn up. So the place where they turn up, that transition is around a density that we understand pretty well. So the turn-up location, the place where these curves turn up, you can understand quite well, is the idea. So the prediction from theory is that the neutron star radius should be around 10, between, say, 10 and 13 kilometers. It's this kind of range here, or this kind of range here in these models. And that's a pretty robust prediction. So what happens after you turn up depends on the high-density equation state, and that can be quite different. You see here different models where they've taken different assumptions about the high density equation of state. But the low density equation of state always, which is the blue part here, always brings you into about 11 kilometers, and then you can go from there. So if we measure the neutron star radius, it should be in this range, 10 to the 13 kilometers, 10 to 13. And if it's not, then that's actually a bit of a problem because it's the low density equation of state that one would think you understand well. That's the argument that's being made. So that's from a theory side. Now, from the observational side, what's been happening? So I'm going to talk a lot about accreting neutron stars. And so here's a cartoon of an accreting neutron star. This is my favorite one, 1820 minus 30. It orbits every 10 minutes. So it's always nice to think about during a talk, you know, just thinking about it going around. So it's about the size. Oh, actually, Earth is to scale here. Earth is to scale. Here's the neutron star at the center of the accretion disk, and it has a very low mass companion. It's a low helium white dwarf, very low mass helium white dwarf companion. This distance here, yeah, well, you can see the Earth to scale.
Yeah,
it's. I can't work out who made it. I can't give it credit. But I saw this many years ago, and now you just can find it on Google. You know, but I don't know. Oh, maybe it could be.
No.
It's such a beautiful picture. It'd be really good. Yeah, it'd be good to find out where it came from.
Yeah.
But it has to be since the advent of X-ray astronomy. You know, so it has to be from the 70s onwards. miles per second. So anyway, but the reason these are interesting is that, so these are neutron stars which have somehow found themselves in a close binary and they're accreting from a companion, which means that we no longer care about the age. So what's interesting about these ones is that they're actually very old. They're probably a few giga years old, typically, or maybe a few hundred million years to a few giga years old. So they're very old neutron stars. They should be very cold. We shouldn't be able to see them. But because they're continuously accreting material, they're being kept hot. And it's a really sort of interesting physics experiment. I'm taking this neutron star and I'm adding material to it and heating it, as I'll talk about. And so they're good systems to look at. And usually you have an accretion disk, you can't see the neutron star, but there are two occasions when you can see them. One is when accretion turns off. Accretion tends to happen in outbursts often. And so when accretion turns off, then the neutron star is left there glowing in X-rays and you can see it. And the other one is that you get these thermonuclear flashes. So I build up hydrogen on the surface and the hydrogen burns unstably every few hours. So every few hours I get a flash, 10-second flash of X-rays, which is coming from thermonuclear reactions. And so I get to look at the neutron star then as well. So these are really good systems to look at because they're sort of in steady state in some sense. They're old. They've been accreting for a long time. They're low magnetic field, 10 to the 8 Gauss, not 10 to the 15. They're 10 to the 8 Gauss. And they have these events where we can see them.
So the companion is a white dwarf? Or what is it?
Well, in this one, it's a helium white dwarf. Okay. But it's very low mass. It's probably, I would guess, around 30 or 40 Jupiter masses. So it's like 0.04 solar mass or something like that. It's very low mass. And it's low mass now because it's lost a lot of mass to its companion. And the reason it's still such low mass, we know that, is because it has to be able to be in a binary that's only 10-minute orbital period. So it has to be a tiny, tiny companion to be able to fit. Right? So it can't be a hydrogen star at all. Any kind of hydrogen star would be too big. It has to be hydrogen depleted. So this is actually an interesting system also because then you know that the neutron star is accepting helium. So you're putting helium on the surface, and there's no hydrogen to worry about. It's all helium, and that simplifies some things. Okay, so people have looked at these and tried to measure radii, and here's sort of a general way in which you think about this. So you predict the thermal spectrum. So here's a couple of examples of calculations of thermal spectra. All helium. It's actually driven by helium, actually. So even if there's hydrogen there, it's driven by helium, and the hydrogen will burn anyway, but it's all driven by helium, it turns out.
And the hydrogen is already there.
No, it's just that in some systems I have a companion which is like the sun, so it'll donate hydrogen and helium. But in this system, I'm just donating helium, so there shouldn't be any hydrogen there. Yeah, they're just different kinds of systems that we know. And there's a whole phenomenology of whether there's hydrogen there or not, and you could tell from the light curves. Okay, so the simple way that people try to measure radii is usually from fitting a thermal spectrum. And so imagine if it was a black body, for example, you'd have some black body spectrum, and if you fit that to your observations, you get the temperature, and then from the overall normalization of the spectrum, how much luminosity I have, I can extract the radius. You know, L equals 4 pi r squared sigma t to the fourth, and I measure t from the spectral peak, and I get the luminosity from the overall luminosity, and so I take the ratio of L to t to the fourth, and that gives me r squared. You know, that's the basic way in which you could do this. And of course, it's not black body. It's a star. It has an atmosphere. It's not a black body. It's distorted, but they're actually very black body-like. And it turns out with current generation X-ray instruments, a black body is good enough to actually fit this. You can just fit this with a black body, it turns out. But it's shifted. It's not a black body at the right effective temperature. It's at a slightly different effective temperature because it's not really an underlying black body. It's a hardened black body because it's a real atmosphere. So the idea is you fit this, and then you get the normalization. And because everything's redshifted, temperature's redshifted once, and luminosity's redshifted twice, you end up measuring, actually, if you look at this coefficient here, you actually end up measuring R infinity, which is the radius times the redshift factor. So it's actually a combination of M and R. And in the mass radius plane, this is what those contours look like. So from the spectrum, I can get a contour in the mass radius plane, which has some kind of constraint that has this kind of shape. And here's a real example. It's from a neutron star in quiescence. You do this for this particular one, X7, and this is the constraint that comes out. So you have to, the mass and radius has to be such that you're living in this red band here.
Okay. But now if you have the two sort of mass measurements, then you have to...
Yes. You can, that's right, you can. So people are just starting to do this. I'll give you a sense, maybe a flavor of that, but that's right. So when you're running your... MCMC in your whatever you're doing here, you could put a prior now, you know, or measure the measured value of two.
So you get mass from the period of rotation.
How
do you get mass?
Oh, actually, sorry, let me say, I didn't answer correctly. We know there is a two-solar mass neutron star, but that doesn't mean that this one couldn't be any mass, right? We just know that the equation of state has to be such that it has to be able to make a two-solar mass. But this one, we don't know the mass. It could be 1.4, it could be 2.5. You know, we just don't know. We don't know the masses. Yeah. So in these accreting systems, it's hard to get the mass because they're so far away. They usually kiloparsecs away. You don't get a good handle on the companion. It's hard to get, let's say, dynamical mass of the companion. They're not pulsars anymore. They're just X-ray bright objects. Yeah.
But if you measure the Doppler effect,
you
get a period and then
yeah. So I guess what I'm saying is it's hard to do that. It's hard to do because they're very far away, so they're extinguished. It's hard to see the companion. For some systems, you can try to do it, and so there are some measurements of these kind of systems, but they have big error bars, and they're not very precisely measured neutron star masses. It's a tough business, and then you don't have a radio pulsar. You sometimes have X-ray pulsations, but you don't have, say, a nice millisecond pulsar that you can time and get the orbit from the Doppler shifts of the timing, either.
So
this
is
actually
galactic.
No, it's galactic. Yeah. Ah, yes, sorry. Z is the neutron star redshift from the neutron star surface.
Gravitational.
Gravitational, yes. Not cosmological, yeah. There's no cosmology in this talk. It's good that nobody left when I said that. Okay. Oh, okay. I should have owned up to this in the beginning. Sorry about that. Okay. Okay, now, so you get a band, and then the other thing that people try to do then is to say, okay, well, I have this degeneracy between M and R. Can I break that somehow? And I can if I can measure one other thing. Imagine if I could measure some other quantity that had a different dependence on M and R, I could break the degeneracy. And so one thing is the Eddington luminosity. And so what people have been doing is looking at these X-ray bursts. So they're thermonuclear flashes. They have an X-ray-like curve that goes up and down. The neutron star gets hot and it cools, and it takes about 10 seconds. And those events can reach Eddington luminosity, so that's where the radiation pressure can defeat gravity, right? It's and that causes the photosphere to move way out. You can see that they're doing this. The photosphere moves out to 100 kilometers or something, because the atmosphere puffs out to 100 kilometers. The photosphere is out at 100 kilometers, and then it comes back within a second or so. And then you know it reached Eddington luminosity. So if you measure the luminosity when it comes back to the surface, you measure the luminosity then, that tells you the Eddington luminosity. And the Eddington luminosity depends on a different combination of M and R. The Newtonian Eddington just goes like M. It doesn't depend on R at all. But if it's redshifted, you get a redshift factor. And then that allows you to then draw a smaller constraint here where I've removed the degeneracy. And so now I have an independent measurement of M and R. And so people try to do that. All right. So what's been going on? Well, here are two compilations, pretty recent compilations. This one's from Ferial Ozel in a review paper, this is taking these accreting neutron stars, looking at X-ray bursts, and just trying to plot on one plot the various constraints that we have, and that there they are. Okay. And then here's a paper from Sebastian Gill, who's a student at McGill. He's working with Bob Rutledge at McGill, and what they've done is they've taken neutron stars in quiescence. So these are X-ray bursts and these are quiescent neutron stars. And what they did in this analysis is they said, let's not worry about the mass. We know that the mass radius relation is fairly vertical. We know these lines are quite vertical. So we're just going to pretend that all neutron stars have the same radius. They're all going to lie on this horizontal, on this vertical part. We're just going to fit for that radius. And they fitted, and they put in five objects. And from those, combining the data from the five objects, they get this allowed range. Okay, so you see they're getting reasonably small, 8 to 10 here. And then these ones are also a little small, 8 to 10. Small compared to that theoretical expectation I was talking about earlier. Okay. So you see we have a lot of measurements here. And the ones I've shown here are a little small. But there are also other examples where they're big. Let me show you those now. Okay. So on the other side, I'm going to put some other compilations that people have done. So here's one object. This is a plot from a paper by Suleimanov et al. They look at one X-ray burst, and the contours, the blue contours there and the green contours show you the radius constraints that they get. And look where their measurement is, it's out of 14, 15 kilometers. So there are X-ray burst analysis that are giving you 9 kilometers, and then there are X-ray burst analysis that are giving you 15 or 16 kilometers. Okay. And then here, Andrew Steiner, and Ed Brown and Jim Latimer is involved in this, I think, also. So what they did is to take a combination. They take a combination of the quiescent ones and the exurbus ones. And they, again, do a similar thing. Then they're not saying that all neutrons have to have the same radius, but they're saying you have to have the same equation of state. So you demand the equation of state be unique amongst all objects, and then you feed that into your Bayesian analysis, and you come out with this constraint here, this red band here. And what's interesting about this one is that this is about exactly what the theoretical expectation is, right? It's in the right place. But you see that there are these systematics here. Something's going on to, you know, some people think that it's 15 from exurbus, some people think that it's 9. And they both have good arguments. They both have good arguments to convince you that they understand the systematics. But clearly, you see here that, you know, if it really comes down to a choice of which arguments about systematics do you believe, then, you know, you really, I think the best thing to do is to say, well, look, this is really an opportunity now to go after these systematics. We really need to understand the systematics before we can really make a good statement here. So there's, in some sense, there's been a convergence of the theory and observations, in the sense that the theory expectation is 10 to 13, and the observations are kind of converging on that. But there's still a big spread, and it's a systematic difference in how you treat the data. And I can say a little bit about this. I have a few slides. I can say a little bit about this. I don't know what time. When should I stop?
0:05.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe I don't know how much I should say about this, actually. But this is really where we've come into this. I have a graduate student, Michael Zamfir at McGill. And the question we've really been looking at is, what are the very systematic effects, first of all? And are there ways in which we can somehow cancel those out? You know, are there kind of observations we can do where the systematics cancel, for example? Okay. And maybe I won't go so much into that, given that I'm about to run out of time. But, well, you know, so you get these completely contradictory statements. I don't want to be facetious about this. But here's one example. So if you measure the hardness of the spectrum in an accreting neutron star, it depends on what state I'm in. So if I'm in a low accretion rate state or a high accretion rate state, I can get a 20% difference in radius from the same object. So there's something systematically going on. If I try to fit the spectrum of an exurbus in two different accretion states from the same object, I get 20% different answers. And part of this debate here has been this group will argue for one state, and this group will argue for the other state as being the one you should use if you really want to measure the neutron star radius. So it's something about the accretion flow. The accretion flow is changing the spectrum in some way. And until we understand that, I don't think it's possible to decide which. You can make arguments, but we really need to understand, what is the accretion flow? What are the surroundings doing to the spectrum? It seems like they're modifying it in some way, because the radius is changing by 20% in the same object at different times if I use different events. Okay, so. Well, you can make so you can make various arguments. So, for example, if I'm in an accretion state where the accretion rate is low, and I have a really bright event that has radius expansion, you might expect that it would push all the gas away. So then I really see a bare neutron star, and I don't have to worry so much about the surroundings. That's one argument you can make. Right? And then the other argument you can make is what people do is they predict. So these plots are the color correction factor. This is how hard am I compared to a black body. So it's the peak of the temperature you infer from fitting a black body, the peak temperature of the spectrum compared to the effective temperature. So one would be black body, and anything up here is harder. And as a function of flux, so as I change the flux, as the X-ray flux declines, the hardness changes, and it's observed to change, and it's predicted to change. And you can also argue, if the behavior I observe looks like the theory, then that's a good argument. I'm really seeing the neutron star surface. And you know, to zeroth order, things look not too bad. Like the green one there shows a dip, and you have a predicted dip here. And I could talk about where that came from. It comes from some ion absorption, but you know, it's well understood where it comes from. And if you see a dip in the data, and you see a dip in the theory, you might say, well, that's actually good evidence that we really are seeing the neutron star surface. But the agreement's not perfect. So zeroth order is quite good, but next order, there are differences. And so we need to understand these differences before we can really do anything concrete, I think. Okay, So, okay, well, the other way to, there is another way to do this, which is measuring pulse shapes as well. So I'll just say that there is work on this, and this is interesting because it's coming. There'll be more of this coming up. But here's a paper by Bogdanov, 2012, and this is a radio pulsar now. It's not an accreting system, but it's a radio pulsar with hot X-ray polar caps. And this is the kind of argument where you look at, so the neutron star is rotating around, and you look at the X-ray light curve in different energies, and it's a compactness kind of argument. So if the neutron star was very compact, there'd be a lot of light bending, and it's hard to make a large amplitude pulsation. So you just model the pulsation amplitude as a function of compactness, and then you can put limits on the compactness. Yeah, this is, I can't remember the, but typically, you know, this could be a second or something. It's the rotation period of the neutron star. So here they're showing, here he's showing stacked, folded light curves over one rotation period or two rotation periods.
So why did it change? So you are saying some there's some spots or something like.
Yeah, the picture is I have a magnetized neutron star. I'd say it's a dipole magnetic field. I have these polar caps, and the polar caps are being heated by particles accelerated back towards the surface. And so they have these hot polar caps, and then I'm rotating, and so it gives me a modulation of the spin.
You're saying that if you have a compact neutron star, and then, so you are relating this to the lensing, set lensing of this?
And then the idea is, imagine if I took a neutron star with just a single hotspot on it, and I let that neutron star rotate, and I predict the light curve. If I make the neutron star very compact, then I start to see substantially more than half a hemisphere, right? A half a sphere is a hemisphere. I start to see, and so I can't make 100% amplitude anymore. For example, if it's compact enough, you know, I always see some kind of luminosity, no matter where I am in rotational phase. That's true, but in these examples, we actually what happens here is that there's a model here of with different size hotspots. You're not putting that in as a measured value. It's marginalized over all these other parameters in your model, like size of hotspot, location of hotspot, the inclination with respect to the observer. I mean, I think actually it has 10 parameters here altogether, two of which are mass and radius, and you marginalize over the other eight. Okay. And the allowed region is these shaded regions here. So if you put somewhere in the yellow band, I can always find, I can choose the other eight parameters so that it works. But if you say the mass and radius is over here, I can't choose those eight parameters so it works. That's the claim. And it's basically compactness is doing it. And the interesting thing about this is that the preferred region, again, is at large radii. So yeah. So if you want to have big effects during neutron star mergers, you want large radii, I've shown you which papers to read. And right. Don't read the other ones. Yeah.
So yellow is 1 sigma, green is 2 sigma.
Yeah. And blue is 3 sigma, yeah.
MSO is the only one that's not
blue. Right, so if this was right, that's right, in terms of these actual equations of state, it's very, you know, it's quite constraining. Well, it doesn't mean, it just means that this star, for example, this one here pokes outside the region, but it doesn't mean that one's ruled out. Because this star could be anywhere on the black curve. But for example, this red strange quark matter curve is ruled out.
I'm also thinking of it that you also have two solar mass.
That's right, that's right. That's right, yeah, that's right. This one doesn't go to 2, that's right. So that doesn't work, yeah, that's right.
Is this data from the two solar mass?
No, but the equation saying has to allow for the two solar mass.
Because that object exists, so,
yeah.
But AP4, for example, would be okay here, right? Although if this observation is right, the radius has to be large, and then, yeah, so. So nicer, yeah, I can't say how much it would, but it's going to get a substantially better measurement of this light curve. That's the idea. So nicer is this mission that was just approved to go on the space station. It's designed exactly to do this. It's called Neutron Star Interior Explorer. something like that. Composition explorer. I don't know. There was an announcement a couple of weeks ago that these two NASA missions, one is TESS, which is a planet hunter, and the other one is this NICER mission. It's exactly going after this question. So,
getting 10 parameters from a light curve is...
Well, you have many data points here. You have many more than 10 degrees of freedom in the measurements. There is, but even if I do that, the claim is that if I plot the marginalized distribution just for M and R, then this is what I get. So the claim is that if I'm over here, there's no choice of the other parameters that will get me there. You know, within 3 sigma. You know, right? So yeah. No. That's true.
You had a claim earlier too about something about the equations of state agreeing and sort of degree density, and you said, well, we know that that could have also been explained by a lot of you could have had things.
Yeah, I think but it's really hard to make. You know, right. We think you have to collapse a core, and so there's a certain minimum mass involved. And for example, if I try to somehow strip half the mass away from each other, so it's very difficult to do that in a stable way that'll give me this object left over, I guess. So often people plot to zero mass, but as you say, realistically, the lowest measured ones we had, 1.2, 1.15, I think, something like that. Gravitational mass, 1.15, something around there. Okay, so that's sort of that's really just giving you a sense, I guess, of where we are. From an astrophysics point of view, it's actually quite interesting because what's happened is that there's been a huge focus now on what are these different systematic effects. So if I take the point of view that I'm interested in these astrophysical properties of these systems, it's actually a very interesting time because it's an opportunity to go after a lot of these different things. And I think the other point is that there is this now there is some convergence between observations and theory. And there's motivation now to just try to go a bit further with this. And I think ultimately what's going to happen is that it'll be measurements from multiple different kinds of systems agreeing that's going to point us in the right direction eventually. You know, I think if you ask me, am I ever going to understand the systematics of X-ray burst measurements well enough to be fully confident? You know, I don't know about that. But if I measure a whole bunch of X-ray bursters, and I measure a whole bunch of radio pulsars, and they all start to agree in the mass radius plane, then I think then we have something. And there's upcoming things. There's NICER, which was mentioned. LOFT is another timing to do pulse profiles. But there's also Gaia, actually, which is doing astrometry. It'll get distances. And a big problem, which I didn't mention, is if you want to measure the radius, you're really measuring the angular size on the sky. So to convert that to a radius, you need the distance. And distances are notoriously uncertain in astronomy, right? So Gaia is going to really help because it'll pin down distances for many of these. Okay, so let's see. Why should I stop now? I can spend 5 minutes on the second half. Okay. So there's a second part, which is this thing called thermal tomography, which is what I've been working on most actually, but I got a bit distracted recently by radius measurements. Okay. So the basic idea is the following. Let me just go through here. I'll just show you this thing here. So imagine if I take a neutron star, I'm accreting onto it. I'm adding hydrogen and helium, but pretty quickly that hydrogen and helium burns to heavy elements, to iron, say iron. And then the iron is compressed to higher and higher density because I'm just keep accreting more and more material. I'm moving each fluid element to higher and higher density and higher and higher pressure. Another way to say it is that if I accrete on an object for a long time, the stuff arriving on the surface has to eventually become part of the core because I'm going to accrete, say, half a solar mass, say. The material that arrives first has to enter the core. And so it undergoes a whole series of nuclear reactions that people have calculated. And so as I go through the crust, my iron nucleus will just undergo a whole series of reactions driven by the increasing Fermi energy. As I go to higher densities, the Fermi energy goes from 0 to 100 MeV. And so pretty quickly, within 10 meters, I have a Fermi energy of a few MeV, and I can start to electron capture. And all of these reactions deposit heat in the neutron star. Yeah. What happens even there is that it always comes back. The vast majority comes back. Yeah. You mean when people try to measure the radius or in the equation of state?
Yeah.
So if I'm interested in just the bulk radius, then if I just look at the core, that's you know most of the radius. So the magnetic field structure, for example, doesn't have a significant impact. So it does on the astrophysical side of if I'm trying to measure what's the size of a hotspot, and you know then it can make a big difference, but not in terms of the structure. Okay, so what's been happening here is that I'll try and show you some data because I'm running out of time here. So here's some data where people look, and this is quite sparse, but here were the first two objects that we looked at. So here are two objects which are cooling over time. You see here's a 1500 days. And what's happened here is that during accretion, they're accreting for 10 years. The two different objects, there and there, two different objects, they were accreting for years. And during those 10 years, the crust was heated significantly by these nuclear reactions that are going on. And then when you look in quiescence, the X-rays, in X-rays you measure the temperature and you see the temperature is dropping over 1500 days. And what's happening is that that hot crust is thermally relaxing. And the point is, just to get you this tomography idea, is the following. If you model that cooling, so I have lots of details here, but I'm gonna show you a movie of the cooling, then how does something cool? It cools from the outside in. If I have a very thin layer near the surface, I cool from low density regions first, where I'm close to the surface, and later. And you see that here, where here's the temperature profile as a function of density. And that's the initial state right after accretion ends. And if you let it cool, you see there's a cooling wave that moves in. And out of that cooling comes a light curve. And in this one, we don't have many data points, but if you just think about what's really going on, it's very powerful in principle, because as the cooling wave marches in, it's just going from one density to another. And so every new data point I measure, I get to look at one more density going in. And that's the game we've been trying to play. And we've been trying to do that with all those light curves I showed you in the beginning, from 10 seconds to 3 years, all kinds of different physics that one can look at. So just to give you a simple, just to maybe just finish up with this one. Go ahead. Yeah, this is the crust, it's crust only. So the core, the boundary of the core is here and the core is there. So this is the outermost 1 kilometer, say, of the star. Both. So if I'm in this half, if I'm about halfway through the crust to the surface, I'll cool through the surface. But if I'm in the inner crust, I tend to cool into the core. And the heat goes into the core and comes out as neutrinos. And you see that in the simulation. If you look really carefully and stare at this, you see that actually the inside parts drop before the cooling wave gets there. And that's because the energy is going in. I think you can see that. Well, if you stare at this long enough, you'll see it. So here, the heat that's deposited here ends up going in. But the one that we see, that the heat, the luminosity that we see is being driven by mostly the outer part cooling down. It's mostly just photon cooling here at the surface. It's just conduction. The electrons conduct heat to the surface, and then we see the luminosity from the surface. The energy that goes into the core will eventually come out as neutrinos, but it takes a long time. Okay, and then just to give an example of, well, what kind of things can one do? Notice here that this cooling curve is a broken power law. Right, so there's some power law here, and then there's a break. Why is there a break? It turns out there's a break for some very simple physics of neutron star crusts, and that's what I was showing in this slide here. So here I'm plotting heat capacity. So I'll just give you this one example. Here's the crust as a function of density. Here's the heat capacity. And you see the heat capacity changes character, going from the outer crust to the inner crust of the star. And in one limit, it's just a classical crystal. In the other limit, it's a Debye suppressed heat capacity, because you're just very, very dense. The Debye temperature is very high. And the change in properties there, there's also a change in conductivity. The change of properties through the crust is really this almost a bimodal change around neutron drip. So what that means is that in these light curves, you get a break, and the break is exactly at the thermal time of neutron drip. So it's really interesting, because for the first time, so for example, you know, this basic neutron star structure, we think that the crust has a neutron drip point. It has free neutrons on the inside, not on the outside. That's never really been able to be tested before. I mean, we have glitches where, and we think that the neutrons are superfluid and glitches are due to superfluid neutrons. But in some sense, that's kind of an indirect measurement. You're relying on arguments about angular momentum and vortices and superfluids. But here, it's a very pretty direct measurement. You just watch this thing cool, and you see a change in behavior right at the neutron drip point. And so it opens up a whole host of questions about neutron star crust. What is the conductivity? What is the superfluid gap temperature, for example? How does that depend on density? And all of these things one can hope to map out. And I have about 15 slides on going through different examples of this. I'm not going to go through it, right? But what we've been doing is, and there's a lot more data now, a lot of these light curves. Okay, so we've been looking at the nuclear structure of the crust. I don't want to show you dirty laundry. We've been looking at molecular dynamics simulation, chemical separation in the solid. When the solid forms, there's chemical separation when you freeze the solid. That has consequences for light curves. You can look at carbon flame propagation. This is, yeah, all a bit crazy, but there's a lot of different things we've been doing. In magnetars, magnetic activity leads to heating, and you see these beautiful thermal relaxations that you can model very, very simply as thermal relaxation of the outer crust. So in the last year, we've been looking at a few magnetar sources. So I think that's really, the big picture is really, if you're interested in neutron star interiors, there's a lot of different observational handles that we can go after now. One of them is thermal tomography that we're applying to a whole bunch of different situations. And the other one is, even in terms of masses and radii, we have this good upper mass limit now in radius measurements. We're sort of identifying what are really the systematic effects. Okay, so if you want to talk to me more, I'll probably stop here. And if you want to talk to me more, there's a lot to say about these different things. Okay. So. So it's thermal diffusion. It really is thermal diffusion.
But I was thinking about, okay, now you have a measurement of high density. But you cool off a little bit, you didn't bring the temperature to zero. So this one is cooling off, but from this layer, it's still hot. So then we get the argument.
Yes, so the idea is, so there's a really simple model you can make of those light curves. I mean, we do a full time-dependent calculation, but there's a simple model you can make that does just as good. So if I do temperature against density, so at the beginning I have some profile, and it happens to be inverted. It happens to be point temperature decreasing inwards. So here's my initial temperature profile. And if I want to make a model of the light curve, if you want to know the luminosity of, say, 10 days, what I do is I calculate where is the thermal time 10 days. So say that's here. And then I go up and I find the temperature profile here. What temperature was it initially at the thermal time 10 days? And if I'm deeper than that, I haven't had time to thermally relax yet. So it hasn't changed. But if I'm at lower density, it's had plenty of time to come into thermal equilibrium. And the thermal equilibrium is a constant flux solution. So I can just make, all I have to do is make, I choose the flux appropriately. So my constant flux solution comes in and hits that point. And then at the next time step, if I go from 10 days to 20 days, I go a bit deeper, say, to here. And now I make another constant flux solution like that. And this tells me the flux at 10 days, the flux at 20 days. And I can just basically go ahead and do that. And eventually it breaks down, because in the inner parts, you go into the core. You're not cooling through the surface. But that's the basic understanding. So there's actually an inversion problem which we haven't done. There's this, it's non-linear diffusion equation, so it's not so trivial to do this, but there's an inversion problem. You can take the initial temperature against density and you map that into luminosity as a function of time. And so if I have six measurements of this, I in principle get six independent measurements of this as a function of depth. And that generalized inversion problem we haven't done. And so it's interesting to think about. It's just like you can go from mass radius relation to pressure density. Right? And the number of measurements here translates into an effective number of measurements there and so on. You know, so there's a nice and interesting inversion problem here to do, I think.
Materials from the accretion disk on the surface of the transistor. That's why you get this profile.
It's because it's not the gravitational energy. This.
No, it's due to the impact.
No, it's due to some kind of thermonuclear heating or some other kind of heating. That's actually.
But you take a very simple profile.
But it looks simple, but it is calculated as. We put in some heating and we let it accrete for 10 years and we calculate how does the temperature adjust. And I think the reason it looks very smooth is because thermal diffusion, over 10 years, you can thermally diffuse and wash out any kinks in the temperature profile. So it's very hard to make a very short scale structure in the temperature profile. It tends to be washed out. If you look at an object that only accreted for a week, then you could have a very sharp heating event. Or if I look in a magnetar, I can heat it by some violent magnetic activity and heat it really quickly. Then I could get more of a sharp temperature profile. And actually, one of those I showed you, the one I flashed up at the end, the very nice red Leica with many data points, that one you can essentially fit with a delta function. It's like you're measuring the Green's function of the crust. If I heat the crust at the right depth, then the early part we don't really see. We only see the late part of the Green's function is the asymptotic. So it's not, you're measuring the asymptotic behavior, actually. So in other words, it doesn't really matter what the initial profile looked like. As long as you only heat down to a shallow depth, what you're seeing is the late time relaxation. And it just beautifully agrees with what you expect, given the conductivity and the heat capacity.
In your simulation, you don't see red heat right?
What you see is you just relax to the core temperature. So what you saw there was it just went flat eventually.
Initially, the core cools very
fast. So all that core cooling I talked about in the beginning is really happening on a long time scale. Let's say the neutron star is a million years old, and it's cooling on a million year time scale. These are young neutron stars, of course. These are old neutron stars that have been reheated, of course. But the point is that all these core processes are very long. It takes 1,000 or 10,000 years for the core to heat up to equilibrium. So you don't see that. You're just seeing really it's the transient behavior coming from the accretion, and then you see the relaxation. But it gives you a measurement of the core temperature though, and that tells you something because you think you know how much you're accreting, and you know how quickly I'm heating, and so on a long time scale that's going to translate into an equilibrium core temperature. And I can measure that after 10 years, it relaxes and I get to measure the core temperature. And so you can learn also about the core as well. So you can learn from the densities at the surface all the way down to the core temperature with these kind of measurements that we have now. Yeah, you have triple alpha reaction driving, and then you have an alpha chain captures going up. So you have very heavy elements, that's right, yeah. So something I flashed by there was a simulation that we've been doing where we take a mixture of heavy elements. It can be a complicated mixture of beyond iron, so very heavy elements that you make during that burning. And then you take those heavy element mixture and you push it to very high Fermi energy for the electrons. So you just take it from Fermi energies of 1 MeV all the way to Fermi energies of, say, 40 MeV. It goes through neutron drip. And we've been calculating what happens to that mixture. Nobody had done that before. Everybody had always just taken iron because it's the obvious nucleus to take. But the observations now, because we've measured the thermal conductivity, we need to understand what the mixture is doing. And so there's really interesting nuclear physics of what goes on when I take this mixture of nuclei and I push it beyond neutron drip. And so the point of this is that you're going from the proton drip line, in terms of nuclear physics, you're going all the way from the proton drip line all the way over to neutron drip and beyond, because I have finite neutron Fermi energy. So I'm actually going, I'm spanning the entire nuclear chart, including beyond neutron drip. So it's, so if the, these observations are really exciting from that point of view, that in this range of timescales, you're going across the nuclear chart. And that we're just beginning to get a handle on that. That's where we're just starting now.
I think there are no more questions, I think.
Okay, good, thanks.